Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm thrilled to have across from me Dave Eggers, whose new novel, A Hologram for the King, crept into my apartment by complete surprise. I wasn't expecting it, didn't know he had a new book, and I think it's wonderful. If there was a testament to the American older, upper middle class, it was once Death of a Salesman, and we still love this play. This is Death of a Salesman, set in the post-industrial America, a man about whom we would have said attention must be paid, and now he's in Saudi Arabia trying to sell merchandise he doesn't much understand, called IT and telepresencing, to the king of Saudi Arabia. And he's ready. How does he know how to talk to the king of Saudi Arabia? Like any salesman, he knows the king's nephew. And rather than this being an extended joke, it's really a melancholy story about how an American can get old and unwanted at this time. There's no wife here to shore him up. The kids aren't around to talk about what he was like. This is a man who's condemned, in a sense, to wander.
Exactly. Well, you know, the idea and this character, Alan Clay, had been forming in my mind for years. And it, you know, I started thinking about, you know, where a man like this is. And I've been hearing a lot about men of this sort of background and this age. And, you know, my friends my age often say, I don't know what to do with these guys. We don't know where to put them, you know, because a lot of their expertise is in manufacturing and in deals on the golf course and in, you know, a different world. And now things move at a different pace and they're done a lot differently and his skills aren't needed. The manufacturing isn't being done here in the U.S. So Alan is adrift, you know, and he's He wonders if he's superfluous. He wonders if he has anything left to offer, if anybody wants to listen to him. And at the same time, he's got one last chance, really, to sort of shore up his financial life, be able to pay his daughter's tuition, pay off some debts, and at the very least, you know, stay in his home and stay with some sense of stability. And that's what That's why he's in Saudi Arabia, but he really doesn't know much else or why he's there. He's quite lost.
Now, I noticed when we first talked how much Donald Barthelme had an effect on you. But now, how many years later is it?
12, maybe?
At
yeah.
least, since A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. Barthelme's voice, if anything, has settled in, not as a show-off, a showpiece voice, but as a mature voice. Mm. You know, if Donald always said, the great American short story writer Donald Barthelme, that he had inherited the Hemingway sentence and this is what he does with it. Mm. He was very proud of having something new to do with the Hemingway sentence. I would say that Dave Eggers is the heir to that sentence, and that sentence has been restored to a reality. Mm. You know, it's a little bit, what's amazing is that the sentence is exotic but clipped. Mm. It's well edited. It's a shapely sentence and can digress, but only within strict lines. I think the amount of work it must have taken to master this was phenomenal. Tell me.
Well, first, thank you for saying all that. Barthelme is, you know, I was over-influenced, I think, by him for a while because he is such a powerful stylist. And I think that I loved his beating heart on the page. I just love. I wanted to. I wish I had known this man. I thought, felt like I did know him, or I wanted to emulate him, both as a writer and as a person. And then, you know, for the last many years, I haven't gone back and reread him because the influence was too strong. But I'm glad that it might have, you know, seeped into my bones in a way. And it maybe the influence is there without it being too overt. But I think this is a book that it started off a little differently. This is a paring down that I've never done before, where I started with something overstuffed, you might say, in a lot of ways, and I pared down and carved for a year from something that was maybe a little wilder and rougher. And that paring down, I think, is what resulted in those sentences. It was a sometimes really painful process, but ultimately something that, you know, I feel results in a more mature work and something that I can look at and from a distance. This is the first book that I've, right after finishing, I think, this is exactly what I try to do, and I can read it without shame. And, you know, usually right after you're finished with something, you're so close to it, and you think, I don't know if it makes any sense or anything. But 4 years ago when I started conceiving of this, this is what I intended to write. You know, when I had Alan Clay, and then when I heard about this place called the King Abdullah Economic City, this sort of city to be by the Red Sea, and I thought, okay, that's where Alan belongs. And I had sort of the atmosphere and the outline of it in my mind 4 years ago. And to have taken a very circuitous route to finally arrive at that place where I wrote what I intended, it was tough but rewarding once you get there.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read from, I think, an extravagantly good chapter. It's chapter 21. We've been told that there's a wife. She's been off stage for the novel. The father has been attempting to write letters to his daughter, protecting the ex-wife, even though he knows that she is a bruising and wounding presence. Her name is Ruby, and halfway through the novel, we finally are going to meet her. We've been warned about her, and we go through the childhood, Alan, too, a shell collector.
And this is the first time I've ever read this aloud, so forgive me. When he was young, he'd been a shell collector. Nothing serious, but he knew the names of some of the basic varieties. He'd had a book, the look and heft of which he could still recall, that listed all the world's most prized and valuable shells. There had been one, Conus gloriarmoris, forgive me, the glory of the sea, said to be worth thousands. He could picture it today, a long cone decorated with thousands of small half-loops, obsessive and seeming hand-drawn. The shell had been incredibly rare. Legend had it that in 1792, a collector, owning one of the world's few specimens, bought another at auction, only to destroy it, making his first specimen more valuable. Alan used to pore over that book, and his mother, thinking the collecting, the memorization of figures, the obsession with risings and fallings of the market, was giving him a sharp mind for business, bought him others, and he memorized the names, the seas where they were found. He rolled his pants up to his knees, and, while bending over, he brought some water to his face. He licked his lips, tasted the salt. When Kit was very young, they would sit on the beach, on the Cape, on the main shoreline, sometimes Newport. She in his lap, they would rake their hands through the rocks and sand, looking for sea glass and notable shells and sand dollars. They compared their findings, dropping the best into a jar they'd emptied of pennies and nickels. He missed her at that age. The size of her then, the weight of her when she sat in his lap. She was 3 and 4 years old then. When he could lift her, he could envelop her. He could hold her close, cover her completely when she cried, smell her matted hair, nuzzle her behind the ear. He nuzzled too much, he knew. He didn't stop when she was 7, when she was 10. Ruby would give him disapproving looks, but he couldn't stop. When she was 14, he still wanted to bury his nose in her neck, smell her skin. He thought of a letter he could write to Kit. He would tell her that her expectations for her mother were unfair. He wondered if Kit knew Ruby had given birth to her naturally, with no drugs, no epidural. Would that impress Kit? Probably not until she tried it herself. Quote, Kit, you say your mother hasn't changed, but she has. 100 times she's changed. It's important to know that with adults, though there is continual development, there is not always improvement. There is change, but not necessarily growth. This was not likely to be helpful, he thought. Maybe he was wrong. Ruby had not changed much at all. She had always been impossible, too strong and too smart and too cruel and all the while too restless to be satisfied with a man who sold bicycles. And everything after their first meeting was a disappointment.
I'm speaking to Dave Eggers about his new book, A Hologram for the King. We're very lucky that we're talking to him really before almost anyone. You're really on in that chapter. But the beauty of writing to a daughter to say that adults don't improve.
Yeah. That's a revelation yeah. for us all, right?
Well, it's gorgeous and it's, you know, truthful and it sounds mature and wise, which are qualities in this book that I would say have not been necessary in the previous books, maturity and wisdom. And they're things I think that as a writer writes become, well, that becomes the guiding principle. Mm. Can you attain maturity? Do you have wisdom to dispense? Mm. And, you know, because there's nothing about the writer's life that necessarily brings wisdom. Life itself either gives it to you or it doesn't.
Right.
What's happening to you that you're gaining wisdom?
Well, you know, I think it started, it reminds me when I was writing What is the What, the story of Valentino Deng, originally that was written in sort of, it would follow the ages of Valentino throughout the book. So when the book begins, he would be 7 and you would see it through his eyes and the language would be limited sort of to, and the insights would be limited to that of a 7 or 8 year old. And then late in the process, I changed it to Valentino looking back on all this time. And you were allowed to then have the distance and even the grim sense of humor about these terrible things. And I think that was when I, at least my approach to narrative and my approach to writing changed a bit and realized that the tools of being able to look back, having lived maybe a lot or too much, and are useful when you're writing a book like this or any book, really. And, you know, a lot changes between maybe 35 and 42. I think I'm 42. I always have to ask my wife, am I 41 or 42? But I think I just turned 42 a few months ago. I didn't celebrate it in any particular way, but that's 20 years there. It might be 7 calendar years, but it felt like 20 to me. And so I feel like I can sympathize or speak through or live in the skin of Alan pretty easily because you do reach a point where the aging process or the process of acquisition of wisdom or at least the frustration of how little wisdom you've acquired, whatever it is, but that's all there. So I think 42 is the same as 56 or 54, however old Alan is. And I think maybe you just project a bit, but you don't even have to that much.
This voice, this man, this 54-year-old Alan Clay, I feel like we haven't heard from him before. His problems, which are nearly universal across America, haven't been given voice or maybe not so clearly. I mean, people might write to me about Louis Begley or someone, but, you know, it's so nice to hear this man have his own book. Mm. You know, it's like giving him a movie studio to play with.
Well, you know, a lot of my friends, my best friends from high school went into manufacturing and consulting. And a lot of my friends in college were engineers. And I didn't know any writers in college really or anything like that. And my high school friends are almost exclusively in fields where they're making things or and they've been trying to navigate those waters for a while. And so when we get together and talk and stuff, it's talking about sort of where things have moved in the last 20 years. They've taken this journey, you know, where, you know, even in the mid-80s, Alan used to work at Schwinn Bicycles, and those were made on the west side of Chicago till the mid-80s, which is a shock to us all, thinking it was 20 years ago that millions of bikes were being churned out in the middle of a city like Chicago. And, of course, now there aren't any bikes made in America outside of a few very high-end ones. And in 20 years, you know, the entire world of, you know, most manufacturing for consumer goods moved abroad, and the supply chain disappeared, and all of that disappeared. And to me, I'm fascinated by that. And I, you know, hearing my friends struggle with, like, holding on to, you know, a buddy of mine has a factory in on the west side of Chicago. They make light bulbs and strobe lights, things like that. But the pressure to move abroad is extreme, and they do business over there. But, you know, I'm interested in that kind of subject, and I'm interested in physical things, and I think, you know, as a publisher of physical objects, you know, like, I have to deal with printers and paper and shipping and distribution and things like that. And so I thought it was time to maybe to see the world through a guy's like Alan's eyes, and a guy that might have been complicit in a lot of this production moving offshore. It's not like he was innocent. He was one of the management guys that made these decisions.
Well, one of the very moving thing, I'm an acknowledgement freak, and you say, at Thompson Shore Printers in Dexter, Michigan, thanks to the entire staff, and then you name them. I think that that's part of the beauty of this book, because this book is a tribute to the people who don't get thanked. The fun of Dave Eggers is that you live as the morality of your books present you. Everyone deserves an acknowledgement.
Well, I had a little journey to get there, actually. It made sense with Hologram because we went back and forth for 6 months on this package before we were ready to go. It made sense to acknowledge them because they put in so much work.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dave Eggers about his new novel, A Hologram for the King. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking to Dave Eggers, who's become, in the process of writing books and publishing books and reinvesting the profits from those books into nonprofit programs for children and for would-be college students. I mean, a genuinely admirable life, a relief to see from time to time, bringing tears to these bookworms' eyes. I've gotten to see, you know, I'm going to be 60 next month. And, you know, I've gotten to see you guys growing up, and I get to see which one of you fulfills your promise as a writer and which one fulfills promise as a humanitarian and, you know, who's telling the truth and who's not, you know, because that's one of the things you realize as you get older. One of the things that's great is that he's a visionary of the book. In this book, A Hologram for the King looks beautiful. Can you describe it? What it makes a book look like this?
About a year ago, when I was revising the book, I had a sense of what it would look like. And so first, you know, you have to pick a material out of a catalog of leatherette kind of materials. They're synthetic leather. And then I knew I wanted it to be very intricate, like a design. So I sought out this designer named Jessica Hishey, who's like a typographer and does beautiful work. And then you go back and forth with the printer maybe 6, 7, 8 times. Like, they do tests, and, you know, this is it's called a blind stamp first. They wrap the leatherette around the cardboard case wrap, and then they hit it hard with a blind stamp that makes a deep groove impression into it. This design is in. And then they have to hit it again with a gold stamp to make the, you know, to highlight the title and everything. And it's... It's tough. It's tough to get it right, but the craftsmanship on this is extraordinary. And it was done right there outside of Detroit, and it was done for an affordable price, very competitive. And so, you know, we're sending anyone we can to Thompson Shore, and there's a lot of other printers that do similar work.
Well, you know, the first one I saw was the cover of the John Sale book, and it was, you know, that before there were paper covers, there were these extraordinarily beautifully embossed covers with designs and croquis and blazons and banners, and that's the model for this. And what's beautiful is here's a guy, an Alan Clay, feeling too old for use. And here's a book mode that's 40, 50 years, 60, 70 years out of fashion. Yeah. So he gets the beautiful book he deserves. He deserves a special cover. He deserves to be embossed. He deserves gold on the binding. It's a book that would do him proud. It says old-fashionedness has its virtues, even as does modernity.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, McSweeney's is a book publisher, and we have 8 staff, and we, you know, the vast majority of our survival is because of physical objects. We don't do a whole lot of electronic sales of anything. So we have to, and we continue to dedicate ourselves to making the physical object something that you want, you know, and something that might survive. And, you know, I think the e-book formats will keep changing. I think the same way that tapes changed to, you know, records turned to tapes, to CDs, now digital. I think that you're going to have these formats that keep changing. And I think electronic books are fine and great. But the physical book hasn't changed in, you know, 1,000 years or however long, not quite 1,000 years. But I think that we want to make objects that will stand for centuries and that you'll want to keep for centuries. And if you do that, small publishers like us might have a chance.
Aren't we asking on some level, are there still readers? You know, are there still books? Will the readers be reading books? And if they aren't, where do we go?
You know? I have a good answer there, yes? Though. Well, I have the benefit. I've been teaching a high school class for 10 years, right? And it's a reading class. We put out a book called The Best American Non-Required Reading. And these are 20 high schoolers every year from all over the Bay Area, mostly public school kids, who choose to spend their Tuesday evenings in a basement of McSweeney's reading the Kenyon Review and reading Granta and reading Mother Jones and reading, you know, mostly obscure literary magazines. And not that those three are obscure literary magazines, but others. And they are completely alive to the written word. They devour books. Any of the books that we get at McSweeney's and Believer that we don't review get it go into a pile. Each one of them walks home with 5 every day. And they are much more dedicated readers than I was at that age. They're much more erudite. They are totally devoted to the physical book, too. None of them do e-readers. Who can afford it, right? And so every Tuesday night, my faith is reinstilled in the future of the book. And
that is so
it feels
cool.
Good.
Let me tell you, David, just last week, only last week, I met with an honors class who had already graduated the Flint Ridge School here in La Canada. They'd spent the year reading Infinite Jest, and they, you know, wanted to meet me because they heard my interviews with David, who was very precious to me. And these kids were so excited. You know, they had already graduated, but they voted to get together because they loved talking about this book. And we had a meal together, and we went to my house, and I showed them my library, and they were not bored to be there. They were thrilled, you know, to be looking at the books. Yeah, I mean, that's what I think, that we don't go to Saudi Arabia or anywhere else, that we got to stay here and reinstill the kind of values that we know in our souls to be permanent ones.
And, you know, if you give them a chance, I mean, I think that the default position of so many people is, well, of course they're not reading anymore. You know, there's just sort of the kids these days mentality, which is just infuriating. But then, and then there's sort of this presumption that, well, okay, books are dead, so let's move on. And it's like this, that's a given. What's next? It's going to be the iPad or it's going to be whatever. And of course, this is not the case. And I think it's a classist argument too. There are no high schoolers that I know that can afford Kindles and iPads and such like that, or that their families would see that as a good use of money when these are going to end up in a landfill 2 years from now. Right now, it's like all the young people I know are still reading books on paper. They still have the same kind of experience where they're enveloped in it. And even our little kids that come into 826 Valencia, we had an experience a couple of years ago. I'll tell two stories. One is that a couple of years ago, Judy Blume was in town, and I asked Judy Blume to come into 826 Valencia, and she did, and I said, I actually didn't know if all these young kids, most of whom are from Spanish-speaking homes, if they all knew Judy Blume and loved her the same way we did when we were kids. She walks in, and mostly boys come up to her, and basically she was tackled. You know what I mean? They would not let her go for 3.5 hours. Everybody stayed late. They were just all over her, signing autographs, questions, all this, from like 6 to 12-year-olds. And mostly all these boys, you know? And it was like, oh, it's incredible. You know, it crossed all lines of generations and gender and class and ethnicity and background and all that stuff. So that was a really great moment. And then my class, my high school class, the Best American Non-Required Reading, every year there's a new introducer to the book. And we've had everyone from Matt Groening to Viggo Mortensen I asked who do you want to do it this year, and they said unequivocally and unanimously Ray Bradbury. So Ray Bradbury was asked, and he wrote the introduction to this year's book, and he passed away about 10 days after he turned it in. But it shows that this is a guy that the pundits would say, oh, I'm sure these young high schoolers aren't reading Ray Bradbury and they don't know what he's all about or care, but you just have to have faith and at least ask, at least listen a little bit before you make presumptions about the youth of America, you know?
I've been talking with Dave Eggers, author, most recently, and we're among the first to be talking about it, author of A Hologram for the King, published by his press, McSweeney's. Thank you, David, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from A Holograph for the King at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.